Welcome along to the Care Team Sessions podcast. This is a podcast of talks from our monthly CPD events. For those that aren't already familiar with us, the West Midlands Care Team is a charity pre-hospital enhanced care team operating in the Birmingham area for over 30 years now. Care Team Sessions CPD events have something for all clinical levels, from community responders right through to experienced in-hospital clinicians, along with medics from other services like police and fire. We want to share the team's knowledge and experience with you, so Care Team Sessions is free to attend or to listen back to on this podcast. It's also an opportunity to raise money for the charity, which would help us to continue to do the work we do. If you'd like a CPD certificate for listening to this podcast, we ask for a donation of £5. Details of how to donate and claim your certificate are in the podcast description. Also, don't forget to follow us on social media, search at WM Care Team. Enjoy the podcast.
This is my background, but this was where the performance analysis side comes from, was from some of my sporting experience, which in a clinical context, we have such little feedback, don't you? It's like patient lived, patient died, like it's pretty arbitrary, analysis of someone's performance. Whereas when I was playing sport, you pour over tape of performances, training, to look at how you could make these small 1% incremental improvements. So I'm going to run over is the non-technical skills, and it sort of gets broken down into these four domains: situational awareness, decision making, communication and teamwork, and then leadership. Because no matter in what context you are, being a follower and being a leader coincide for everybody. And then we'll look at some performance analysis depending on how we're getting on. So the airline industry and the safety profile and pilot training is kind of held as the kind of ultimate, isn't it? Like they do so much training, they do lots of simulation, and yet actually not belittling their profession in any way, but it's rather formulaic, isn't it? They've got an aircraft that they know and that they run, and when problems happen, they've got very kind of set ways about handling them, and they train for that all the time. And then in medicine, it's just like chaos, isn't it? Like every variable we can different between every case that we go to. So actually, when you try and analogize these, this is a far more difficult problem to try and solve in what we do. However, when we're trying to look at how we improve our performance and how we try and overcome some of the difficult challenges that we face, something that struck me when I found this out, that even fighter pilots have a checklist for emergency ejection. It's only got two lines on it. It just says, check canopy, pull handle, but there's a checklist for that. And then there's even one for kind of non-emergency where they're trying to do even like nice term, isn't it? Controlled bailout, when you're literally just gonna jump out of a plane going at like whatever, Mach, whatever it is. So how the use of sort of aid memoirs, checklists, and how we go about using those and not seeing them as a crutch, but they're a performance analysis tool for us to use. So a slight kind of pedantic point, but what we mean the difference between something that's complex and something that's complicated. So a complex problem is something that's got multiple stages to it. However, something that's complicated is something that's made more difficult to deal with, do or understand. So you can have a complicated, complex task. Yeah? Does that make sense? So then we contrast that to, trying to do some invasive procedure for a patient, out of hospital. Being able to use a procedural checklist, in my opinion, is a very valuable thing to try and use. And really, we prepare really hard for the kind of rare and difficult things. But actually, how do we incorporate that into our day-to-day practice? So looking at these non-technical skills then, and I don't know if any of these terms will be familiar to people. So they get a bit broken down, and I apologize for being slightly ill-prepared, but I'm gonna read them off a little bit and then try and expand on some of those. So situational awareness gets broken down, and there's a lot of overlap perhaps after this, but being able to gather information, okay? And this happens continuously. But in that first instance, when we assess a situation, we're gathering information. We then have to try and be able to understand that information, yeah? So I can go to the back of the computer box and see, I can definitely see that there are lots of different coloured wires back there. But do I know what those wires are and which one does the green one? And so there's a difference between gathering that information and being able to understand what it is, and then being able to project and anticipate the future states. So I look at the back of the computer and I see that there's some smoke coming from the back of it. I probably don't want to stick my face really close to it because I might project that actually there might be a fire and it might blow up in my face if I start messing with the wires. So, and again, you can break this down to perception, comprehension, and then projection. Okay. Following so far? Makes sense. Then once we've had that situational awareness, then we have to try and make decisions based upon it. We have to try and consider what the options are. Red light, green light, okay. We're pretty au fait with that. You know, unless you're in the Fast and the Furious, there's probably only one option that you really should make. Hit the brake pedal. But then actually selecting that decision, communicating that decision, either if it's to your own feet or to another member of your team, and then actually implementing that decision, and then taking stock of what's happened. Oh God, it's red light, I'm pressing the brakes, actually it's not stopping. I need to try and do something else. And this is how it becomes cyclical between decision-making and situational awareness. Within then the teamwork elements of this, there's communication, isn't it? And we very rarely, in clinical context, work as individuals or try and take on a single task individually. So we therefore have to somehow have a degree of exchange of information, establish what shared understanding there is at that time. Because again, I don't have the cartoon of it, but you've all seen the six, the first standing on this side and there's another person standing on the other side and goes, no, it's nine. Yeah. And then the coordination of those team efforts. Yeah. So how we go about leading that team. And then these leadership standards, although they kind of come in and out, and this is where I say that followership is something that perhaps doesn't get added into this, but is very equally important, to set and maintain standards, to support others, and then to be able to cope with the pressure that comes depending on the severity of the case that we're dealing with. Technical skills are, you know, prerequisite in the work that gets done in clinical medicine. However, there's a fallibility in actually being able to do it to a good standard if we don't consider those non-technical skills. So I'll sort of just gently pause there. Does anybody have any questions about non-technical skills and sort of, or any comments how they've reflected on their own work or been in difficult situations like that? Do those things echo true in what you've experienced before?
When working on the road and you've got different responders, I think, yeah, you definitely think about your sort of crew resource management in that you turn out and you assume everyone's on the same playing field, but actually they're not. So it's trying to gauge that and deliver what needs to happen to those people effectively without getting them defensive.
Yeah. Absolutely. And this is how we try and sort of function through all of that, isn't it? So I'm sure many of you are, you know, delivering ethane reports when one arrives at a particular scene. It doesn't really necessarily matter. It doesn't have to be some huge, you know, explosion, bus crash, Siamese twins on fire up a tree to need to give an ethane. Like, but actually that passage of information in a very concise manner. The other analogy I make is towards at-mist handovers. Again, I'm sure you're all familiar with those. However, have you ever tried giving a tismah? Yeah? Because actually trying to receive that information in a format that you're not actually attuned to is really difficult, and you remember so much less of it. Similarly, the same if you go beyond the sort of 45, 60 second time span. Again, people are starting to lose information that you're conveying. So then we need to try then and be reflective about our performance and what we're doing as to how we deliver our performance to make things better. So if you know that, you know, actually taking 30 seconds, 2 minutes to prepare an at-mist before you're going to deliver your handover will improve the outcome of that handover incredibly, because you can spend 5 minutes trying to give your at-mist handover and people will take in less of it than you would have if you'd taken 2 minutes to prepare it.
Yeah.
So then if we look at our performance analysis, and then how do we determine what is a good performance? Do we go by outcomes? Already mentioned, you know, survival, the rather binary outcome. Times, you know, some people judge on-scene times, time to hospital, time doing a procedure. Perceived success. I thought it went well. I thought tonight went well. That might be completely different from what you lot think. I think it went all right. Intervention success. So I tried to make the iPad work. They tried to get a surgical airway in. Actually, does it matter how long it took or how disjointed it was or how many bits of kit that they went through, but they actually got the surgical airway in? Do we have key performance indicators, a set of, not guides necessarily, but markers that we're looking at in terms of what we're doing? Doing your driving test is a, you know, key performance indicator, isn't it? Because the driving instructor's marking you as you go through. And then a little bit towards the perceived success of, we've got subjective accounts and then we've got objective accounts. Yeah. How I look back after we've finished tonight, or how I look back at my last operation or the last major case that we dealt with, versus, and I'm sure you'll have all been through this, you know, somebody saying in a debrief, oh, I had no idea about that, or did it was that really 20 minutes? You know, those things, that's subjective accounts. But then objective accounts are things that actually you can see in black and white or color HD if they've got a good camera. But even to that extent, that's a very narrow perspective of an objective account, isn't it? We can try and analyze our performance by feedback. We can do case reviews, we can have peer reviews. These can sometimes be in a formal manner. Unfortunately, the NHS culture is that it's all relatively negative, isn't it? In hospitals, they have these things called Datixes, or, you know, these IR1 forms, get 54'd for something that didn't go right. There's been some tried to be some culture change, and people might have heard of a Gratix. So this is actually responding to positive feedback or trying to, you know, highlight good practice. Or it can be informal, having a debrief, speaking over a case with somebody telling you did a good job. We can try and analyze our performance by metacognition. And this is a bit random science-y, but this is the science of thinking about thinking. So we have a knowledge of how we think and then how we regulate that. So the anecdote that I give for this, and again, sorry, I just don't have a better example on the top of my head, but so for the people that work at the sharp end of things with guns, US police force, you know, special forces, army people, that, like, what they did was they took them and you've all seen the, you know, on the television and stuff like that, where they do the practice shooting pellets at paper targets, yeah? And they line up at the door, yeah? And they're gonna burst in and shoot all the bad guys and try and not shoot the people who are there kind of waving, but I'm a civilian, don't shoot me kind of thing. What they did was they put them through those tests and looked at their scores, how accurate they were at getting the bad guy and the good guy, or not hitting the good guy, and then how close their groupings were. And then what they gave them was a very simple kind of technique to try and calm themselves down, called box breathing. It's a bit around, but essentially, breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds. Yeah? And they got them to do that, to calm themselves down, to bring themselves into this purple patch, the arousement, not that kind of arousement, but that state of being in the right zone. You'll have heard that term, I'm sure. Yeah. And they found that not only did they hit the right people more often, but they also got better accuracy with what they were shooting. So then that's an aspect about trying to regulate how one goes into a stressful situation, and by knowing oneself to try and perform better. And being able to handle the stress, and you'll have all been in stressful situations and you'll handle it very individually. It's trying to take knowing oneself, I feel like I'm in the Matrix now, and being able to learn how that you're going to deal with those situations as best you can. What overlays within a lot of our situational awareness and our decision making comes in with cognitive bias. okay? These things that sway us in our job. I'm sure you'll have, I'm trying to look around the, maybe one or two grey beards in amongst us. You walk into a case, you've seen it 100 times before, and you just kind of know what's going on. And a trainee with you or somebody more junior, and they're kind of like trying to pick up on it, and you just get it right, don't you? Because you've seen it. And you've got a degree of cognitive bias within that. And that experiential is very useful. That experience is very useful. However, there are a few areas where that can become a bit limiting. So am I going to remember to get these right? I don't know. So anchoring bias or diagnosis momentum. Yeah, I bring in a patient into the emergency department and I tell them they've got reduced air entry on the right side. I think they've got a pneumothorax. Okay. And then that person that goes to listen with that knowledge already there is more likely to hear reduced air entry on the right side. And the team are already thinking that this is a pneumothorax, yeah? Rightly or wrongly, but that's how their decision is therefore biased, and their what they hear, even though they might hear air entry, and it might be normal, but their decision has been anchored by a prior piece of information. I think this is gonna pop up, hopefully. So this Dunning-Kruger effect, or the blind spot bias, I'm probably somewhere up here, aren't I, at the moment, thinking this is going well. This, our wisdom and our experience contrast against our confidence, okay? So as you start doing something new, everybody's hesitant, aren't they? Low in confidence, start to try to get to grips with a problem. And that often, that confidence rises pretty quickly. I've got this. I know how to work the IT. Got the microphone set up. Should be going okay. And then as we get a bit wiser, I've done this a few times, and perhaps I messed this up and I've forgotten to turn the microphone on in my pocket, or I've knocked it off as I've been prantling about. And that's where you start to then descend from Mount Stupid to the Valley of Despair, where I feel like I've got to check every 5 minutes. Like, yeah, it's still on. Okay, yeah, got to do that. And then as we start to experience, become wiser in that, our confidence starts to build again, and we climb the slope of enlightenment to the point where I think it's on, and I think I've got my finger on the right button each time to move the slides on, to the point where then our performance plateaus and we become almost the best version that we can be. Yeah. Search satisfaction bias. Okay, so this is quite an important one, and that's why I bring it up. Finding injuries or spotting diagnoses on an ECG, let's say. When one finds something that you were expecting, there's often a tendency then to stop looking, okay? So looking on a chest x-ray and I'm trying to spot all the rib fractures that are on that x-ray, and I completely miss that there's a big pericardial effusion that will kill the patient much quicker than their rib fractures, yeah? Because I was looking for rib fractures, and that's search satisfaction. And then in a similar fashion that we get confirmation bias, that actually they said it was a pneumothorax. I heard decreased air entry. I've blind spot bias, completely missed that they've got a big scar across their chest from previous surgery. And so I think there's reduced air entry. They said it was reduced air entry as well. They think it's a pneumothorax. I think it's a pneumothorax, and I'm going to do a thoracostomy in their chest. And actually, it turns out that patient had their lung taken out 10 years ago. Yeah. These are some of those difficulties that one can get into with cognitive biases. So when we then think about how we might tackle problems, and if I put this to you or those that are working or training, if you were going to a medical cardiac arrest in a 50-year-old patient, and how you would approach that, how you would handle that situation, what clinical interventions you would do, and how you would sort that, okay? What level of mental rehearsal does one go through to try and improve the performance that you deliver when going to that particular task? And then when we change that you know, we could rehearse that now, we could go to a 50-year-old. And then we change that and we go to it being a 25-year-old or an 85-year-old. What can we extrapolate from that mental rehearsal that we made before? Because, yeah, Johnny Wilkinson goes around and he kicks from every minute spot on every white line there. And then the referee gives a penalty and it's between two white lines. He just goes back to his rehearsed practice to try and execute that kick in that spot, in that stadium, at that time in the game, to try and make sure that he gets it through. Yeah. And then we look at performance analysis, or how we can improve our performance, with these things called nudges. And so this rather odd picture is from Amsterdam Airport. And they analysed looking at the men's urinals and how clean, or how many times they had to clean it in a day to make sure that it wasn't filthy. And what they went with was this hunch that they would try and put a fly in the urinal. And it was at a sweet spot on the curvature of it to try and reduce the amount of splash that happens. And it turns out that men are quite keen at targeting something. And they found that by doing that, they reduced the amount of filth that accumulated on the floor. And this is a behavioral nudge, yeah? Something that you wouldn't really think about. There's no reason why I should go and try and aim at something. But human behavior is a nudge. It's the same for the way that organ donation has been changed, hasn't it? So do people go out and actively put themselves down on the donor register? No, they don't mind. They would be quite happy to donate, but they didn't do it. So what did the government do? They decided to try and change the process, and it was an opt-out system then. So if you really don't want to donate your organs, then please fill in this form, we won't take them. But actually, if you didn't mind, or you'd actually want to, we've done it for you. This is a nudge in a direction that's trying to make some form of social or humanitarian improvement in the situation or the performance of our national organ donation rate. And so what I kind of leave you with, as I hopefully get towards the end of this talk, are to try and then think about some of these things that you might go out in your day-to-day practice, you know, revision calendar, setup, whatever it might be, to think about how you might implement some form of a nudge, putting your car keys, you know, in the same spot when you get home every time so you don't panic, you know, when you're late 5 minutes and you can't find your car keys. Some small nudge that might improve the way that you go about doing something, anything, but hopefully something towards directing some form of life-saving intervention. Welcome.
That's it for this Care Team Sessions podcast. You'll find information on how to get your CPD certificate in the podcast description. If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any future episodes. You can also follow us on social media at WM Care Team. Thanks for listening.